This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of PDF game products, and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
My name is Harley Stroh, and I'm the line editor for the Goodman Games Dungeon Crawl Classics, and you are about to enter the Vorpal Network.
Hi, I'm Steve Kenson of Green Ronin Publishing. You're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 113. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. Excuse me, sir, do you have your ticket? In this episode, we're going to be riding the lightning rail to chase after an airship in hopes of stopping the Lord of Blades from subverting the draconic prophecy about Argon Essen with a look at the Eberron campaign guide and player's guide. All aboard! In this episode, I'm joined by a bevy of fantastic guests. We bring back Jeremiah McCoy from the Basics of the Game podcast and the local Eberron aficionado. Welcome back, sir.
Hello.
We also have Ken Newquist of Nuketown, the blog and the podcast. Ken's kind of been on the podcast way back in the day when
this
he contributed
shame,
a review,
creator of Deadlands
but
Reloaded,
it's been a very long time,
Worlds,
so he's practically new to the show. So welcome back.
Hi.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And as I understand it, you have about a similar level of familiarity with Eberron that I have, where we've read a bit on it and we played a little bit, but really don't consider ourselves experts on the setting.
Yeah, I've just always tucked it away as a campaign I'd run someday.
Yeah. And then we lastly have Nick DiPetrello. Did I say it right?
DiPetrello.
Yes.
Close enough.
All right. Nick DiPetrello from Dungeon Mastering, who's playing the role of our Eberron noob.
That's right.
As I understand it, you haven't dealt with Eberron until 4th edition and come into the setting with no experience from the previous edition.
I knew it was where Warforged came from.
Yeah.
That about sums it up.
So you're welcome back to the show as well, of course. You were on one other time?
Yes, we talked to James Wyatt.
Yeah, for the interview, the big 1 year later interview. Good. So today we have two books to review, which means there's a lot to go over, and we're going to try to go into some detail. I have a couple of goals. First, I want someone who's completely new to Eberron to be able to get a good feel for what the setting is like, as it's presented in the new campaign and player's guides. And second, I want someone who's already familiar with Eberron to get a feel for how the new books play into this Eberron setting. It's kind of a tall order, but I think we have just the folks here to make it happen. Do you guys think you're up to the challenge?
Of course. Okay.
I guess we'll find out.
Good.
Indeed.
Good. All right, but first I want to mention our sponsor for the episode, RPGNow.com. My RPGNow.com pick of the episode is Player Options, Merits, and Flaws from Alia Publishing Group. This PDF is under $2 and gives you a whole new system for flaws for D&D 4th edition. The idea being that you take a flaw, like conservative, which forces you to repeat an at-will attack that you took that hit last round, but you gain an extra feat as a result. The flaws are divided up by role, so the flaws that work well to flavor a striker are different from the flaws for a controller. All in all, it's an interesting system. It seems to me the flaws tend to be a little bit worse than the benefit, but I can see how this would bring a lot of great flavor to a game, and for under $2 at RPGNow.com, why not check it out?
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
All right, so the first book we're going to look at is the Eberron Campaign Guide. I figure that's a good place to start to get a feel for the world before we get into a lot of the crunch and mechanics in the other book. This was written by James Wyatt and Keith Baker. And let's start off by talking about what is the point of this book. What is the Eberron Campaign Guide trying to do?
Well, first off, They changed things up when we came up on 4th edition on how they were going to do settings. They decided they were going to do two books. So you got your player's guide and you got your campaign guide. Campaign guide is for DMs. Player's Guide is for players. It's pretty straightforward in that regard.
Okay. So this is the book for DMs.
Definitely.
And it's intended to give sort of everything a DM would need to run a game in Eberron.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it gives you a good overview of the entire setting, but I think it also does a good job of providing you with a lot of fodder for adventures. I think you could randomly pick almost any page in this book and find an adventure idea, which is, I think, what do you want from a campaign guide?
Okay. I'm going to agree with that.
Okay, and that ties in well to our first chapter, which is about running adventures in Eberron. They dedicated an entire chapter to what an adventure in Eberron is like. Why is it that Eberron needs a chapter on that kind of specificity? You know, most camp settings don't require a specific chapter just to explain how adventures work. We know how adventures work. It's D&D. They're adventures. Why is Eberron different?
Well, Eberron has a slightly different edge to it. All of those things that you know in D&D, you can do in Eberron. I mean, the dungeon crawl, deal with the noble and go to this town and fight off some orcs, and all of those things are there. I mean, they're fine, but they add some elements as well. They add some intrigue elements. They add some investigative elements that are more strongly emphasized in Eberron. And also, if you're running Eberron and there isn't a point where you're hanging off of, you have your players at least hanging off of something while a battle is going on around them and they're traveling at a high rate of speed, there's something wrong.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the way I viewed Eberron in third edition, and I think this is equally true in fourth edition, is I think it's the perfect setting for GMs who are itching to try something out, you know, maybe a different genre or a subgenre, but you have a group that's not quite willing to give up fantasy. So with Eberron, you can do that classic dungeon crawl, but like you were saying, you can have high adventure, you can have noir, you can have pulp, you know. I think that's what makes it so appealing to me, is that you have all these different possibilities. And I think you need to explain that in the book so that people get a sense of, you know, this isn't just classic D&D. There's a lot more you can do with it.
As a new player coming to Eberron, that section for me was sort of like the travel brochure. Like, here are the things you can do in Eberron. You know, all the fun adventures you'll have. Like, you might go to a resort and they'd show off, you know, oh, we've got hang gliding and parasailing. And for me, it's like, okay, Eberron, we've got lightning rails and airships and noir and dragon-marked houses. It's all the fun things you can do there, spelled out.
Well, and this chapter also provides a lot of the, I mean, as a campaign guide book, it you don't expect a lot of crunch, a lot of mechanics. But a lot of the mechanics you do find, you find in this chapter, where they give you sample NPCs for various organizations that are out there in the world trying to do things. They give you statistics for different mounts that you might have in the setting that may not exist in other places. You know, if you want to ride around on your tamed dinosaur, this is where you get the stats for that.
Well, not in the first section generally, though.
No, but in this book it is.
Well, okay, yeah.
Yeah, they've got it. And I think some of the other things that they do is they also introduce the idea of magic in this world, which is a little different from what you're normally finding in D&D, and especially in 4th edition, where you have the whole candles in the darkness kind of thing. Magic is very pervasive in this world, so, you know, it's a magical civilization. Technology isn't nearly as important as arcane invention. So that's how you get the lightning rail, and that's how you get the airships. And I think that's an important element that you kind of want to be able to say, okay, well, it's not uber magic. It's not like, you know, the Forgotten Realms at its highest end. It's more everyday magic. You know, you walk into a shop and there's this guy who can repair your sword, but he's probably going to be some sort of an artificer who's able to use magic to do that. He's not going to necessarily go in the back and start wailing on it with a hammer.
Right. And in particular, an example of an encounter that you might find in this setting is something like, you're having a battle on the top of a lightning rail while being circled by halflings riding on the backs of pterodactyls. I mean, this is an encounter that you would run into in Eberron. And this section definitely sort of, these are these elements that you will see.
Yeah. Good. So the second chapter then they start small. The second chapter is where they start explaining the world to you in more detail, right? And rather than saying this is the mainland where all the adventures happen and talk about Corvair and that kind of thing, they start off by saying, let's look at Sharn. One city. Why does one city in Eberron deserve its own chapter when every other chapter covers whole slews of kingdoms?
Because there's more going on in Sharn than most other games have in entire kingdoms.
Okay, so explain Sharn to me.
Okay, I'll go for it. Sharn is it's an eternal city type thing. You know, Waterdeep's a little bit like it. A couple of other eternal city settings. In this one in particular, it's built from the ground up in that you have the lower levels, you have the middle levels, the upper levels, and even a level that floats above the city. The whole city is a vertical element. And you can have adventures that will take you so far into the depths that you're, you know, in ancient times almost as far as the architecture. Or you can, you know, have political intrigue on a floating portion of the city, you know, a half mile above the ground.
Yeah, I think it encapsulates everything that Eberron's about. And I think that by reading through the chapters, you kind of get a feel for the political intrigue, you know, the high adventure, the, you know, the pulp, everything that we just discussed, you can find in this one city. And the fact that it is a vertical city where you're going to be running across bridges to get from building to building, or you're going to be jumping onto airships, or you might jump out of the top story of a building because that's what the bad guy just did. This is the place where you're going to do all that stuff. And I think that's why they lead off with it, because it really kind of encapsulates what the world's about. But I'd be curious to know how it worked for the newcomer to Eberron. I mean, the Sharn City of Towers book is the only other Eberron book that I bought, so I knew a lot about it.
Yeah, but if you read the Eberron novels, they also use Sharn as like the first point of contact. So it is established as sort of the welcome gate to Eberron. It tells you what it's all about.
Yep. It's definitely, here's a good place to start.
Well, and I found it interesting because a lot of stories, a lot of adventures in role-playing games and that kind of thing, you start off local. You know, you start off in one area, and then slowly the world expands from there as they tell more and more of the story. And I almost felt like they organized the book to do the same thing. Start with one city, and then expand from there and look at the world around that, and then expand further and look at more of the world, and then go on and past all that and look at the whole planet, you know?
We should add the note, though. Sharn is cool enough that you could run a campaign just in Sharn.
You could.
And never leave it and have plenty to do.
Well, I was just going to say, I can't remember whose tagline it was, but, you know, from here you can go anywhere. And I think that's the really cool thing about Sharn is, like you're saying, you know, you could stay in the whole city the whole time, but it's so easy to just throw out some plot lines and send people, you know, across the entire continent just from this one city.
Yeah. And in fairness, you know, it's not like they gave it a chapter of equal weight of the next chapter, for example, that talks about five whole kingdoms. Right. It's a relatively short chapter that leads into the next chapter about the five nations. So let's go ahead and talk about the five nations. Why are those five nations separated off from the rest of the world?
Well, I guess, I mean, one of the key things about Eberron is that it was, the events of this book take place, I think it's 4 years after the end of the last war. And basically the last war came about when there used to be a kingdom, I think it's called Galifar, right?
Right.
Okay. Yep. Galifar was this great and noble kingdom, a pinnacle of civilization for 1,000 years. And it was comprised of these five smaller nation states. And when the last king died, they had a war of succession, basically. And then these five nations went to war against one another. And the culminating event of that war was the creation of the Mornland, in which one of the kingdoms known as, I think it's Ciri, was destroyed by this magical apocalypse. So I think another kind of key aspect of Eberron is that you have this war kind of looming in the background. You know, there's kind of this forced peace that came about when the Mornland was created because nobody wanted to keep on fighting because they had no idea what destroyed an entire nation. But all the stresses are still there. All the intrigue is still there. And while no one may be willing to go to war, you know, they're still fighting with one another, but behind the, you know, in this kind of sustained Cold War. So I think it's important to have these five nations so that you can get all those tensions out there.
Yeah, it's in a lot of ways, you know, you look at traditional pulp or noir stories, and in the analogy here is that the last war is World War One. You know, right. there was this great massive thing, and a lot of people suffered. And is it really over? Not really. There's still a lot of tension there. They might have peace for a few decades, but that tension is still there, and it could break out into World War II at any given moment. So that
Civil War South is another sort of example of what might happen. I mean, there's a lot of grudges to settle. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that, you know, maybe needs killing after the last war. You never know. One thing that should be said up front is some of these nations are very much, this is stuff that you will see anywhere. I mean, Andare and Breland, they're pretty close to any general fantasy setting. You're going to, you know, be pretty easy to sink into them. Karnath is a little odd because it has an accepted use of undead, but it's not necessarily an evil nation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, in Thay is pretty much, no, these guys are evil. Insert Thay for, you know, trade Thay for Nazi and you're fine in Forgotten Realms.
Sure. But that doesn't, that analogy doesn't work in Eberron.
Right.
Karnath uses undead as servants, but they're simply a tool. They're not, you know, they're not raising an undead army to wipe out their enemies.
They're just raising an undead army to bolster their allies.
And that sort of brings out one of the themes of Eberron, I think, in that Eberron, unlike a lot of other settings, is not a world of black and white. There's a lot more gray. And, you know, it's not just all these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, you know. There are things that are generally accepted in other settings as being evil, like having an army of undead, which in Eberron is not necessarily considered evil.
Depending on where you're from.
Sure.
Like the folks from Thrain with the Silver Flame, undead are evil and need to be destroyed.
Sure, but it's more about those relationships and the people involved than it is about this overall concept of this is good, this is evil, and there's no debate on it.
Yeah, it's not a binary proposition most of the time.
Okay, so we've talked about four of the five kingdoms already then, with Andare and Breland being sort of your traditional high fantasy Renaissance sort of typical world or kingdoms, and then Karnath being the one that has the undead around, and Thrain being the one that's led by religious zealots.
Right.
The only one we didn't talk about then, and it was mentioned briefly before, is the Mornland, which used to be, I believe, Ken, you called it Syrie, and I usually pronounce it Sire.
I've heard it called Seer. Or
Seer works too.
So
it's been destroyed. Who cares?
The problem with all these settings where you make up the words is that nobody knows how to pronounce it. But today it's called the Mornland, and it's just sort of this land of death filled with this gray fog. Healing doesn't quite work right. The ghosts of the dead kingdom still sort of wander. There's a lot of mysteries going on here.
It's a creepy place. There was a published adventure where they emphasized that you should describe this battlefield where everybody looks like they just fell over. Like there's no rot. Everybody looks like they just fell over. The ones that weren't perhaps injured in the fight are just, they look like they're sleeping. That's creepy. Because they've been dead for 4 years now. And they're just, you walk through and everybody looks like they're asleep.
Yeah, I think it definitely has something of a Ravenloft feel to it, in so much as, you know, you wander into the, you know, you go into the mists and there's a good chance that you're not going to come out. I think it's a very cool place in that, you know, they've never explained the mystery. This book doesn't explain the mystery either. You know, so that's just kind of lingering out there. And they give you a lot of strong hints as to what it might be, but they never reveal it. I don't think they revealed it in third edition. I don't have the book, so I couldn't say. No,
in fact, I've heard it said by the people involved in it that they never plan on revealing it in a novel, in a source book, or in anything. They want to leave that as a mystery that you get to explore as players in the setting.
And they've deliberately given hints to multiple things that it could have been. In different books, depending on which one you read.
Well, and that sort of brings out another theme of Eberron, is that they really want you as somebody playing in this setting to be the main character, to be the hero. You know,
yeah.
The most powerful NPCs in the setting are like 21st level, whereas players can get up to 30th, you know, and most NPCs in the setting are significantly lower than that. You know, the most powerful people in the world are going to end up being the players. They're the heroes. They're the ones out there doing things. And in the same way, things like the Mornland, they leave it mysterious on purpose. That's for you to tell that story. They don't want to tell us the story of the setting. They want us to play the story.
It should be added that the Mornland is also the home for one of the iconic bad guys of the setting, which is the Lord of Blades.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of Warforged supremacist, and his followers, and he's a bad man.
Well, and he's the most powerful NPC I've seen in the book, and he's 21st level.
Actually, in the first section, they list some epic level bad guys.
Do they?
That the Lords of Dust.
Oh, sure.
Which are sort of global. These guys are bad, and they give some stats. There's like a level 34 solo controller, a level 29 elite controller in there.
Well, that, so.
I think the good thing about the setting is that you're going to, like Jeff was saying, you're going to be able to bring in the threats to face that the PCs are going to face at 20th level and above. So, I mean, because of Eberron's history, you've got this Age of Demons where there were all these demons, and I think it was the dragons who banished them.
The dragons,
or the giants,
the Quaddles.
Ah, yes, the Quaddles. Thank you. So the point is that they're not gone, right? They're just locked up. Yeah. So you never know when one of these things could come back. So if you needed, you know, your epic final battle at 30th level, you've got it in the form of some demon lord. And we have it in the history of Eberron where they've occasionally popped up. So I think you've got no limit to the amount of number of threats you can come up with at high level.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on the Five Nations before we look at the rest of the main continent of Corvair?
I will add that one of the major themes in the thing that should be brought up is not only are they still tense about the last war, but everyone expects the next war to start. So being familiar with those five nations and how their politics interacts will help you make a game where that is likely to happen and understand what will happen.
I think it's also worth noting that, especially compared to the Forgotten Realms campaign guide, I think that the interaction or the inclusion of 4E mechanics in Eberron is a much more subtle, much more organic thing than it was with Forgotten Realms. I mean, Forgotten Realms is like a thermonuclear strike against the setting. I mean, leap the timeline ahead, 100 years, kill off a few gods, smash two worlds together. I mean, it was apocalyptic. If you loved Eberron the way it was, I think it's going to be really familiar here. And I just kind of had to mention that just because, the Forgotten Realms was such a radical change, and it just kind of works here. And I think we see that in the Five Nations.
And it seems like we're comparing a lot between Eberron and Forgotten Realms, but I guess in fairness, those are the only two campaign settings that have been published at this point, so it's fair to compare. Nick, do you have any last thoughts? You've been quiet.
I just wanted to mention there's a lot of the inter-country stuff, but I feel like each of the nations has enough meat on it that you could do an entire campaign in just one nation and not worry about political machinations if that's not your thing.
Yeah, it's true. Well, and like McCoy said before, you could easily run an entire campaign and never leave the city of Sharn. But that we're not limited to those five nations or the city of Sharn. There are a whole slew of other areas in the next chapter, which is called Greater Corvair. Corvair being the main continent where most of the action happens. Let's go through these quickly and talk a little bit about all these other areas of Corvair. Who wants to tell us about Dargoon?
All right. Dargoon is odd. that's the first place to start with it. It is settled primarily by sort of, well, what would be bad guys in most other settings. And they're not necessarily bad in this one. It's settled by the criminals and everyone else who escaped the war, pretty much.
And hobgoblins and all those guys, right?
Yeah, the hobgoblins definitely are in power there as well. Now, and they reckon back to an old empire before humans got to Corvair. It was the age of monsters. And they're kind of pulling on that imagery to form their kingdom. And because everybody was kind of weak after the last war was over, when they said, we're a kingdom now, no one could say anything about it.
Right. Another area that is a little less wild, as much as Dargoon being ruled by hobgoblins is a pretty rough and tumble place. You can get a little bit rougher and look at the Demon Waste. The demon Waste is sort of this corner of Corvair that never really quite got over the Age of Demons. The land was shaped by the demons, and there's still a lot of demonic influence in there. It's a very wild sort of place. Not a real hospitable location to most people for long periods of time.
Yeah, it's got cracks running through it down into what is called Kyber. We should add the cosmology of the world has a dragon above, the dragon of the world, and the dragon below. Sybaris is the dragon above. Eberron is the dragon of the world, and Kyber is the dragon of the underworld.
Yes,
basically where all evil comes from. And it's wrapped up inside Eberron. And sometimes the cracks open up down into the underworld. And demons come out. And, their whole society is set up to dealing with that. And this is one place where there's a big crack in the world.
Right.
And this is where your Lords of Dust hang out and your Rakasa.
Rakshasa.
Rakshasa, thank you. Which I think is cool. I mean, that just kind of goes back to the whole, well, what are you going to do when you hit 20th level? Well, let's go visit the Demon Wastes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of locations in Eberron where you make forays into them, but you don't stick around for very long. You know, the Mornland is one of them, and the Demon Waste is the other one. You know, these just aren't good places to set up your base of operations.
But they do very clearly name them. Nobody's going to go into the Demon Wastes and think it's going to be a happy place.
Right. The Mornland doesn't seem to be real happy and shiny either. The next one on our list is Droam.
Droam? Yeah. Droam is, it's another monster kingdom. It's populated with trolls and gargoyles and goblins, and there is one major city called the Great Cag, which is Great Crag rather, which is ruled by all the monster races. Don't come here unless if you're a human, or you'll be lunch.
And it's ruled by three kind of all-seeing hags. There's a coven that rules over this thing, which I think is just really cool. Because, I mean, honestly, if you're going to have, like, this divine hags who are capable of seeing into the future and picking out what's going to happen, why wouldn't they rule a nation, right?
Sure. Yeah. And then we have the Eldine Reaches.
Yeah, the Eldine Reaches. It's kind of pure wilderness. It's the sort of untamed You know, you go here in the forest, you find lots of elves, you'll find lots of, you know, things of the wood here.
This is the home of your druids and wardens and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they have a bit of a history and a bit of a story to the world as well, where there's been a history of encroachment of creatures from beyond.
Zoriat.
Aberrations and that kind of thing. And these druids have sort of banded together in an organization specifically designed to make sure that these portals stay closed and there's no more invasions from Zoriat.
Yeah, they've been secretly protecting the world from all the things that would come to eat it.
Right. Then we move into the Lazar Principalities. For those of you,
I think this is another good example of a place where Eberron can just kind of support almost any campaign that you want to run, because this is the place for the pirates.
Yeah, this is your swashbuckling section of the setting.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Not unlike kind of a cross between Pirates of the Caribbean and I don't know, the Dutch.
It's a bunch of islands. It's relative lawlessness. It's just a series of pirate holds, that kind of thing.
Right.
Then we get into the Maror holds.
This is your dwarven kingdom, with all that entails. One thing that's interesting about the dwarves in this setting, though, is they're also the bankers.
Which makes some sense.
Yeah, they're the ones with all the money. So, don't make them angry.
Well, I really liked the backstory here, where the dwarves come up from the dragon below, and they settle these different mountain strongholds. But they're all so focused on being clans and trying to dominate, each clan vying for control of the area and trying to, you know, one up one another, that they're never able to form a cohesive nation until humanity comes along and, you know, forces them to join Gallifrey as part of the empire. Then, when everything falls apart, you know, after a couple hundred years of rule over the humans, they kind of got their act together and said, well, you know, we don't have to actively fight against one another. We can form our own kingdom. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea I love the backstory where they're not just, you know, for, you know, hold and hearth and all dwarves are unified together. And I also like that there's a dwarven homeland where you can say, I'm from here. Because a lot of settings, you know, it hints at the fact that there was a dwarven homeland, but you never really get to go there.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then we have Kabara. This is your lizard folk kingdom?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember. What did they have living there under third edition? Do they have Dragonborn equivalents then?
I think it was mainly just lizard folk.
It was a lizard folk thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think you can find Naga there and some other sort of lizard folk related stuff. It's jungles and swamps, so they're welcome to it, you know. But... But it's ancient kingdoms hidden in the jungles and swamps. So it's good fodder for, we're going to go do this raid into the jungle and find this ancient hoodad that we need to save the world. That kind of thing could easily be run there. Pretty, you know, kind of the Tarzan-esque, the sort of pulp. Running around in the jungle type thing could be running Kabara pretty easily.
But Kim also mentioned that this is now where we're going to find Dragonborn, which is going to be a change from 3rd edition to 4th, because we didn't have Dragonborn before.
Right.
How did the Dragonborn fit into Eberron?
Okay. The Dragonborn... There are two or three races that are new to Eberron this time around.
Mm-hmm.
Dragonborn being one of them. They fit very nicely, because really they come from, another place called Arganasen, which is where all the dragons live.
Yes.
And the Dragonborn immigrated to Kopara at some point in the past, but they're all from Arganasen. And they very much were subject to the whims of the dragons in Arganasen. So that's why some of them left.
So are the Dragonborn in Kabara now attempting to sort of forge their own destiny, you know, get away from the dragon sort of thing? How is it that they ended up here in the swamps?
Well, for one thing, it's the first piece of land you run into on the way from Tarkov. So
accident of geography.
Yeah, pretty much an accident of geography. Now, they don't have any large settlements here.
Which would explain why you could have a campaign in third edition and not really ever run into them.
Yeah,
yeah. I think the 4E backstory is that they basically founded their own kingdoms in this place, and then they were all destroyed in a big fight with the Naga,
yeah,
or something along those lines.
Yeah. Now, Nick, as somebody new to this setting, did it feel like Dragonborn fit smoothly into the setting, or did it feel a little bit tacked on?
It felt natural to me because I like the idea of a little bit more savage Dragonborn, you know, the jungle dwellers. And I like that setting as a whole because it reminds me of sort of Indiana Jones type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I love doing ancient temples and ruins you can explore. And if they're full of murderous lizard people, all the better.
Good. So let's go ahead and talk about the Shadow Marches.
All right.
More marshland and swamps.
Yeah, more marshes, more swamps. Less like your standard jungle thing. They're a little more like the bayou, I guess.
Okay.
A lot more swamp and a lot less jungle. That makes sense.
And this is where you're going to run into your orcs.
Yeah, there are a lot of orcs. I mean, you'll run into orcs in Drome and other places, but in this particular place, there are some orcs.
Well, and they sort of set it up as, you know, this is probably the, as much as there can be an orc homeland, this is probably it.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly has that feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, there are a lot of dragon shards that fell in the area, so there's a lot to draw you there.
And it should be noted, dragon shards are chunks of the ancient three dragons crystals,
right,
that have innate magical properties, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the mechanics of that later on in the next book.
Right.
So then we get to the Talinta Plains. This is where you find your dinosaur riding halflings.
Indeed.
Which is so awesome. I mean, I got to say that, you know, throwing dinosaurs into something can feel really cheesy and just kind of out of place, but I think it just worked.
It kind of does. You know, when I first learned about Eberron, I'm like, really? Dinosaurs with halflings on their backs? This doesn't quite feel right to me. It felt a little cheesy, but playing in Eberron, it works, you know?
Yeah.
Because everything else is over the top and everything else is very pulpy that way, suddenly having a place where there's dinosaurs running around on the savannah and halflings happen to live there as well, it all comes together.
Yeah, this is like the steppes in Africa. The setting is the beasts, the wildlife are more like that. So having the halfling riding the dinosaur across the African steppes, you know, with the long grass and the hot and all of that. I think that makes a nice image.
Yes.
And it also opens up the possibility of dinosaurs in other areas of Eberron.
Right. Absolutely.
Which is perfect, right? Why is this T-Rex in the Kabara and jungles? Well, why wouldn't there be? There's dinosaurs over here too, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And then probably one of my favorite kingdoms is next, and that's Valinor, which is the elven kingdom. And it's basically, as I understand it, a bunch of elves were brought in as mercenaries during the war. And as the war wound down, they just sort of said, yeah, we're not leaving. We're just going to stay here, and this is going to be our land now.
Yeah.
Am I understanding that right?
They claim to have a heritage that's like millennia old, and that their society has always been separate and all this. But yeah, it's a relatively recent kingdom from the standpoint of the rest of the nations. And they are a little different from the other elves in the campaign setting. They're almost Arab.
They've got sort of that feel to them. Yeah, I mean they're consummate horsemen, but they're also very. They've got a strong warrior bent to them. I mean, it's a warrior culture. I mean, because it was founded by mercenaries, right? So it makes sense.
They have a unique weapon that to their culture called the double scimitar.
Yes,
which is, you know, it's kind of what it sounds like. It's like a Klingon weapon or something, you know, with the blades on either end, and they'll go riding along and attack people on either side with it. And it's they're a very cool culture.
Yeah. And then we get into the last of this chapter, which is Zilargo.
The homeland of the gnomes.
The gnome land, which, I mean, it works out well that this book came out after Player's Handbook 2, right?
Yeah, I don't think you could have done this book without Player's Handbook 2.
Right.
No.
Because you wouldn't have had your druids, you wouldn't have had your gnomes. Even as it is, you're missing some key elements of the setting when it comes to psionics and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
right. I like Zilargo partly because I hate the "ooh, I'm a monster" ad for gnomes. I think the gnomes in Zilargo would take that gnome and quietly disappear him. Which I love.
while I disagree with you on the ad because I thought it was funny, the Zilargo kingdom. It's all the intrigue of all of the courts in the world. Only shorter. they're pretty cool. They changed the history on them a slight tad from the third edition.
Okay.
Just in that they had them coming out of the Feywild through the spires because they introduced the Fey spires that were stuck in Eberron, and that really wasn't an emphasized element in the previous one.
Right.
But
it's an element that plays into some other races, too, that we'll talk about when we get into the player's guide.
Right, but from a standpoint of the history, they changed it a tad from the history that they had in the previous version of Eberron, but only just a tad.
Yep. So this is your realm of high, high intrigue. You know, a lot of social pretense, but, you know, everybody smiles at you with you know, one time, and then they're stabbing you in the back the next time.
Yeah, aren't they great?
they always show the gnomes in these sort of high fantasy versions of almost Renaissance or Victorian sort of garb.
Yeah, makes me want to play a gnome.
But there's more. Go on, going beyond Corvair, beyond that main.
Wait, we should make a point.
Okay.
They make the point in the book that the assumed setting of this book is Corvair. All of this other stuff is kind of put in as flavor stuff for you to go, you know, go on a single adventure here or have a character that's from here, but they don't actually give you enough information to really run long-term campaigns in any of these other places that are not Corvair.
That's correct. And I think that can be evidenced by the fact that we've spent nearly a half hour talking about Corvair.
Right.
So, but there are some, they do detail the other parts of the world, which is different than some other settings. Again, compared to the Forgotten Realms, where you have a whole planet and they detailed two continents, you know, and there's a lot more than two continents on that planet. But right. they don't give you any information at all about any of those because there's enough to explore in the ones you have.
Right.
The first one on our list is Arinol, which is our elven homeland.
Yep.
But so unlike your standard elven homelands.
Oh, yes. Even with the minor changes that they made from 4th edition because of the inclusion of the Eladrin and their sort of Feywild origins. Arinol elves worship their dead.
But they're not really dead, right? Because the planes, the plane of shadow intersects with Eberron here, so their ancestors are up and walking around.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, they can consult with their revered ancestors.
Right. It's you got a lot of sort of Asian influence ancestor worship mixed with a lot of voodoo imagery.
With yeah.
The skull painted faces and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, this will be kind of one of the points where you will have a moment of, for new people, hey, you need to explain that this is different from elves that you're used to.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I was just going to say the same. I mean, they have the Undying Court, which is basically the highest of the high elves who are all undead. And I think that's one of the cool things about Eberron, that, you know, just because you cohort with undead does not make you evil. It doesn't even make the undead evil, right? I mean, here's a whole nation that's basically directed by undead, but they're considered good. And I think that could throw some players for a loop.
I would be interested in our newbie's view on this, that's never approached Eberron before 4th edition, what your view of this particular take on elves was.
I love it, because generally when you have players walk into an elf town, you go, you know, it's an elf town, there's trees around, there's elves. These, I feel like you could describe the city and describe the people living in it, and if you didn't tell your players they were elves, they'd have no idea what they were. It would be something completely new to them.
Yeah, it's a very the setting of Arendal feels very unique. You know, I'm not able to point to anything else that's quite like this. And then we've talked a little bit about Arganesen, which is one of the ones that gets a lot of the attention, I think, because this is where your dragons are from.
Yeah. In third edition, Arganesen was this be where all the epic stuff is. You've gone through, you know, the first 15, 17 levels. Then you start thinking, well, maybe we'll go to Arganesen, where all the dragons are. Because that's the only way you're going to survive. And they kind of kept that. I'm amused that the Arganesen book that they came out with for in third edition was supposedly fourth edition compliant.
Well, although if you look at they don't give you much, but they do give you some stats for creatures in Arganesen, and you have a 14th level, a 17th level, and a 22nd level. They really statted things out to be geared towards Paragon play, upper Paragon play.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's without even throwing in the dragons themselves. I mean, the other important thing about Eberron is that there's the concept of the dragon prophecy, which I think we'll get into a little more when we talk about dragon marks. But the dragon prophecy has basically been laid down from the very earliest days of Eberron's world. And the dragons are constantly trying to interpret the prophecy, trying to see what's coming next, manipulating the world to either bring it into alliance with the prophecy. You have different dragons who have different interpretations of it. And I mean, it's a good chunk of the engine that drives some of the intrigue in Eberron.
It's also a good chunk of the ancient history starts with Arganesen, because the first really intelligent race on the planet are the dragons.
Sure.
I mean, the world's creation myth involves great dragons. So, you know, a lot of, if you really want the big story, you kind of need to eventually come to Arganesen. Also, as a side note, it is where you find Tiamat.
That's something I was going to ask about, because I don't remember Tiamat being in the third edition version of Eberron.
Tiamat was in the third edition version.
Was she okay?
Yeah. She did not make it into the main book, but she was brought up in a couple of the other books, including the Arganesen book, obviously.
Okay.
And basically, she's a Lord of Dust. And and she's been bound in a place called the Pit of Five Sorrows. And if she ever escapes, all the dragons will go mad and kill all of us.
Sweet.
How's that for epic?
All right. Let's get the heck out of Arganesson then.
Yeah.
Next up is Sarlona. This is our psionic realm, if you will.
You get without the benefit of having psionic rules.
Without the benefit of having psionic rules. But this is where you would run into a lot of your psionic sort of stories. You've got kingdoms being ruled by creatures from Zoriat and you know, beyond the pale, and taking over people's minds and manipulating their dreams and doing all those kinds of things. And creating whole... so this is also the area where you get whole stories of that creates this new race, the Kalashtar, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, in particular, the Kalashtar are the heroes of this story. Riedra, which is the major nation in Sarlona, is ruled by the bad guys in the story of Sarlona. The Delcor are from the realms of madness and dream, and they basically, when they show up, they take over human beings, kind of hollow them out and control them from inside, and their evil is not the "I'm going to throw fire from the skies." No, their evil is "I'm going to take your dreams."
Yep.
Nicely insidious.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the other cool thing is that this illustrates another nice mechanic within Eberron, which is the idea of it intersecting occasionally with different planes, and that the planes basically kind of have orbits that bring them back to Eberron and to contact with Eberron.
Yeah.
And that can have implications for the world as things can cross over from one to the other. And a related concept is the idea of manifest zones. When we were talking about Skarn earlier, that's in a manifest zone that's associated with one of the elemental air planes, if I remember correctly.
Sure.
So I think the cool thing about that is if you wanted to have an area where you're like, oh, you know, I really would like to have this kind of like fire elemental thing with lots of fire elemental creatures. Well, just make it a manifest area related to fire, and you can do that without actually having to go off on this huge planar adventure.
Well, and it also means that as a DM, I can craft my campaigns and my stories in such a way that makes sense, that there's one big global threat the PCs need to worry about. You don't have to have them rushing off to both make sure that Tiamat stays chained up and run off to Sarlona to stop the invasion of people from beyond. You know, you don't have to take care of all these massive global threats at once, because not all of them might be threats at the same time. You know, you may not have the planes intersecting very strongly at this, you know, for the next few years, and so you're safe to just focus on one threat at a time, and it makes sense in the story of the setting.
But you probably should have them running all over and doing all those things.
Well, at some point.
I mean,
well, one of the great things with Eberron is you can actually get from place to place without, you know, 2 months of walking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly.
I mean, you got lightning rails. You've got elemental controlled land carts, elemental powered sailing vessels, airships. I mean, transportation is not a problem in this setting.
Nope.
And it's not just for epic people. You know, a peasant can buy a ticket on a light rail.
Right.
Yeah.
Although one place that most people don't travel is our next area of Zindrik.
I love Zindrik.
As a minor note, the actual online MMO, Dungeons & Dragons Online, is set in Zindrik.
Yes. And this is a wild place, largely untamed jungles and mountains and what have you. Populated by giants and drow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. Good.
It was. This is where the giant empire existed way long ago, before they were put down by the dragons. So you've got all these really cool ruins. I mean, it's like we were going to talk about with Kabara, only more so. You know, there's so much here to explore, and if you're going for that Indiana Jones kind of pulpy feel, this is a really just another great place to do it.
This is where the Temple of Doom would have been.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the giants had really epic scale magic because, well, they're giants, and what else are you going to have?
Sure.
So, that you know, if you want to have the mystic woodah of whatchamacallit, it's a good place to go.
Yep. And then,
I think I was just going to say, just from a DM, like, dungeon design standpoint, the idea of building a dungeon to scale to giants right?
Yeah.
Would be awesome. I mean, it would just be this great challenge for PCs to have, you know, this thing that everything is, you know, 10 times as big as it needs to be because it was scaled for giants.
Sure.
Yeah. I just imagine a great tomb crawl where your players get to the end, find the artifact, and realize they can't pick it up because it's made for giants.
Good. And then the last one on our list is Kyber itself, which is, McCoy had mentioned earlier, is the dragon below, which really translates into Eberron's version of the Underdark. It's all the caverns and things in, within the below the crust of the earth, I guess. But this is also where you have a lot of the nasty, odd, deformed creatures of Eberron coming out.
It is the Underdark. It is also sort of bordering on hell.
Yes. I mean, it's the Underdark, but at the same time, it's not the Underdark you know, because, again, this isn't where the drow are. This isn't where you find all these dark mirrors of the surface races. Instead, it's where you find these horrible creatures that sometimes bubble up and cause all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
And I think they go out of their way to kind of illustrate it as a world onto itself. You're going to be adventuring through here and you're going to find caverns the size of mountains. You know, in a conventional Underdark, at least in Greyhawk, maybe a little less so in Forgotten Realms, they still kind of keep it as a network of caverns, right? You're not going to have these huge expanses underground. Whereas in Kyber, you're going to have that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So that is that chapter. We have a couple more to look at. We've got dragon marks in the next chapter, and this goes into a lot of detail of the different houses of dragon marks, and the politics and the different people running these things. But let's just briefly talk about what are dragon marks, and we'll talk about the mechanics of them when we get to that later on.
Well, it is the great mystery of the setting, as to where the dragon marks are coming from and what their origin is. Specifically, they are pretty clearly related to the dragon prophecy. And that is, you know, pretty hard to deny when they, you know, can actually read lines of the prophecy written on people.
Yeah, it's essentially marks or almost tattoos that just appear on people. And they tend to stick to certain marks appear within certain races or certain sections of certain races even.
Right. Although they have changed it from third editions where you, if you were of some races, you just couldn't have them.
Yes.
To now occasionally, you know, if you're any race can have one. So you might end up with a Warforged with one, which would be weird, but
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is kind of – that is one of the big changes they made where basically the purpose was they basically said for everybody else in the world it works the same as it did in third. But for players, we'll let you do whatever you want because you're the player. You get to be the exception to the rule is sort of right. How I feel like they went with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, good God, given all the intrigue that exists in Eberron, if you took something that wasn't part of your normal race, like a Warforged, who got, you know, the mark of whatever, you know, couldn't you see all these houses scheming to get that one Warforged to find out why it happened?
Oh, yeah. Well, and that sort of brings up another point, is that the dragon marks add a whole new layer to the intrigue and politics that's already going on amongst the kingdoms, because people organize around these dragon marks and form dragon mark houses.
And which are essentially kind of like medieval guilds to a certain extent. They control certain aspects of society's business.
Yeah. I think of them a lot as non-governmental organizations.
You know, yeah.
I find them, they're like very aristocratic too, because they interbreed to try and keep the mark around and, you know, they have very strong family ties too.
Yeah, there's strong family ties. There is a sense of superiority there, but different houses focus on different things. You know, the Caneth house is the house of crafting. You know, they're the ones that created the Warforged, and which we'll talk about in a bit. You know, and then there's other ones that focus on communication and focus on transportation, and so they do different things that play into, like McCoy was saying, the business and the economics of the setting.
Right. If you, for instance, want to go somewhere, on the ocean or on an airship, you're probably going to talk to somebody who is at least in the employ of House Lirandar. Whereas if you want to have a magic item made, you're going to talk to House Kenneth.
Right. And then we get into another area where we talk about all the shades of gray in Eberron, and that's the chapter on gods and cosmology.
Woohoo!
Because unlike a lot of fantasy settings, in Eberron, we don't actually know that the gods exist. We don't know that there's an afterlife. You know, in other settings, like, again, the Forgotten Realms, you know that there are gods, because every now and then, they come down and walk around with you and talk to you. In Eberron, the gods are more distant, and you have to take it more on a matter of faith.
Well, it actually depends on which gods you're talking about.
That's true, too.
For instance, the Silver Flame technically doesn't worship a god, but they can pretty clearly point to, look, there's the Silver Flame.
Yes, because it's a big silver flame.
There's somebody in it.
Yes.
And it will talk to you if you talk to it.
Perhaps you should go talk to them. No,
but it's a matter of faith that it's a god and not just some highly magical thing.
Right. The Blood of Vol technically doesn't believe in gods, but Vol is a person.
Yes.
So
who has statistics and is only 19th level?
Spoilers.
Yeah. I don't know how they get away with making her only 19th level, but yeah, she's 19th level. Her story is so epic. Like thousands of years ago, she was the first offspring between dragons and elves, and her entire house was wiped out to keep her from existing. And when she was killed, the last thing her mother did before she was killed was turn her the dead daughter into a lich.
Yeah, it's pretty epic. She should really be more like 28.
I'm like, why this person? Why this is not like a like epic scale bad guy is beyond me.
Yeah, like 30, 35, you know, something.
Yeah, really. I mean, maybe after she achieves her apotheosis,
right?
Then maybe she could be that.
But she's at least indestructible.
Yeah. Well. So is the level 14 lich that my players keep running into.
We'll get him eventually.
He is not as cool as Vol should be, I'm saying.
and then there's other gods as well. I mean, you have people will worship the Sovereign Host, you know, which is actually lots of gods.
Right.
But you can worship them as a whole pantheon.
Yeah, and they are what you were talking about. Right. These are gods that you can't actually say for sure that they're real. Now, the interesting bit is they actually may be based on dragons.
Sure. Is that hinted at in this book, though?
Yes. Actually, if you make a religion check high enough, you find out that they are very similar to the ascended masters of the dragons. And that's probably the origin of where the gods came from.
So, and then you have their counterparts of the Dark Six, which are, you know, these six evil gods, which is a nice touch.
I am going to add also, this is a good point to point out the difference in format in this book over, say, the campaign guide for Forgotten Realms, which is every section begins with what you can find out with a specific kind of check.
Yes. Which is very useful.
Yeah, like several pages of, okay, you've got a religion check. All right, at DC 15, you get this. DC 20, you get this. At DC 25, you get this, and so on. Then you have the history checks, and, you know, it depends on what subject you're looking at. But they went through and said, okay, if he does a check on any of this, this is what you tell.
Yeah.
Makes it much easier.
And they've also taken the cosmology of Eberron and sort of wiggled it around so that it fits into the new, larger cosmology of D&D.
Sort of.
I mean, you look at it at first and you think that they've just said, forget it, we'll make our own cosmology, and then you realize, no, they're kind of saying that Kyber is the elemental chaos.
Kind of.
And that Sybaris is kind of the astral sea.
Kind of.
Yeah. It's not a perfect fit, is it?
No. Here's the thing. They made some adjustments from third edition, because third edition Eberron, one of the big things is, no, this doesn't interact with any of the other worlds that you made. Yeah, you're not going to have a portal from with Elminster stepping out into Eberron and looking around and going, well, that's very interesting. Yeah. No, doesn't happen. And it really doesn't happen here either. They put in some structures to make it easier transition-wise for people who are already used to the fourth edition cosmology. But really, it's still radically different, and you probably shouldn't be, you know, I didn't get on the Hostile Sea and I sail my ship from the Forgotten Realms to Eberron. No.
Right. Right. I think it's there also so that, you know, as a DM, you can easily flip through the monster manual and go, okay, well, this is this kind of creature. Clearly, right. This is where it belongs.
The other big difference was actually there were cycles that were set, you know, like astrological cycles that would make certain zones interact with the world more often at certain points. And they kind of got rid of that and said, well, it happens, but really it happens when the game master says it does.
Which I like better, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is something I probably would have done anyway as a game master in Eberron, because I'm going to change the cycles to better suit my campaign.
Yeah.
And then they finish the book off with an appendix, which is actually a sample of first-level adventure.
Yeah.
Is it any good, and do we need it? Because I've generally been kind of iffy on sample adventures and campaign guides.
Well, actually, I looked through it, and it's not terrible. The first adventure that was in the Eberron Guide for 3rd Edition was actually a good launching off point into a line of three published adventures that they did. This one doesn't feel like it's going to be a jumping off point into published adventures, but it does actually bring up one of the things that they try and emphasize. To a certain extent, this is for advanced game masters. The first adventure they have listed in here is a flashback. Oh. The adventure is what you were doing on the day of mourning, the day that the Mornlands were formed. And then after you get through that point, you jump ahead 4 years.
It's an interesting take, though.
Yeah. In the game mastering advice, they talk about doing things like time travel and flashbacks and things like that.
Yes.
Because they want you to remind people that this war was just this, you know, just 4 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, you don't want them to not remember. You want to remind them that this is leaving marks on people's psychology and things like that. Storytelling for impact.
Yep.
I guess is a good way of looking at it.
Good. Any other thoughts on that adventure?
In general terms, I don't really care about a sample adventure at the end of a campaign guide. Because after I've read a campaign guide, I've got, you know, 100 ideas in my head, and the last thing I want to do is run someone else's adventure.
Yeah, on one hand, I always feel like it's a good idea, because you get somebody new who has no idea how to run an adventure. Maybe it's good to get them this, you know, help them get their feet wet. On the other hand, I've said in the past, I don't like sample adventures because you're going to use it once. And then I'm going to lug around those pages in this book for the rest of my life. Well, or at least until the next edition comes out. And I'll never use them again. I'll use them once at most. And honestly, I probably won't use it the once. But where they did better in this than they did in the Forgotten Realms campaign guide is that at least they put it at the end. In the Forgotten Realms campaign guide, it was the first chapter.
Yeah, in the Forgotten Realms guide, I was like, well, I skipped that chapter.
Yeah. Well, and something else that they did here was they gave you a nice big fold-out map
Yeah.
of the world.
Well, yeah, I think actually I have the same opinion though about the map that you have about the adventure. The front of the map is awesome because it's the world. It's actually Korriban, right? You flip it over though, it's an encounter map, which I'm going to use once.
Yeah, I haven't
maybe
actually,
twice.
I haven't punched mine out yet to see what's on the other side.
Yeah. I would have rather had the big map of the world.
I'll just put the big map of the world on my wall and leave it, call it a day.
Yeah. So all in all, I'd say as a campaign guide, this is very complete. One of the complaints that was bandied around with Forgotten Realms is that the book is that it wasn't very thorough. This feels very thorough to me.
The other thing that is nice is, because they didn't change the setting, you can always pick up those third edition books.
Yeah.
And they won't have stats that you can use, but they will certainly have setting information. They will have all the fluff that you need.
And most of those books were fluff. Most of those books were story.
Yeah.
All right.
I think there's one last thing I want to say, because I always it's a pet peeve of mine,
yes,
but they actually have a halfway decent index in this book.
Yeah.
I love indexes, especially as a DM, I love indexes. It's only a one-page index. Two, technically, if you have there's also a list of all the new monsters and what pages they appear on, including their level and role. So, I mean, between those two things, I was pretty pleased. Especially, I didn't actually have it in hand, but from what I understand, the Forgotten Realms index was more of a suggestion of ideas than an honest to God index. It was like a half page at the back of the book.
Yeah, they Wizards hasn't done a very good job with indexes since 4th edition came out, so it's good that they did a better job in this one. And the monster listing is almost essential.
Yeah.
They've listed monsters in every chapter. There's no section to go for monsters, so they need to have that in there to not drive us insane.
You mean you're not using the Dungeons and Dragons, initiative, whatever it is, the DDI, the digital initiative where you get to go to the compendium and look up every monster?
I do.
Okay.
So I guess that solves my problem, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's move on because we've talked at length, and let's look at the Eberron Player's Guide by David Noonan, Ari Marmel, and Robert J. Schwab.
Woohoo!
This is where we get a lot of the crunch and fun bits of Eberron. The purpose of this book, I think, is to give somebody everything they need as a player to play in Eberron.
Interesting note, the campaign guide and the player's guide, the first two pages are almost identical.
The introduction?
Yeah.
Sure.
The 10 facts are exactly the same.
I think this is the same 10 facts that were in every introduction to every Eberron book in 3rd edition as well.
Yeah.
But that's one of my favorite things about the book, though.
Yeah.
I open it up, 10 facts, and I want to play this.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. It absolutely is. And to help guide you into this, is they start off with chapter 1, which is called Life in Eberron, and it's really your campaign primer.
Yeah.
This is the world in a nutshell. In one chapter, the things that we told you in the whole book of the campaign guide is summarized in one chapter for the players. Yeah. So I guess rather than reiterating things we've already talked about, I just want to cover, did they do enough? Is there enough in that chapter that as a player of Eberron, I can feel comfortable not buying the campaign guide, that I can read this chapter and be ready to jump into adventure?
Yes and no. Yes, if you're playing a character from Korriban, there's enough there. If you're planning on playing something from somewhere else, like Sarlona or Argonasan or Zendrick or something, then you might want to look at a little beyond this.
Sure. And that's legitimate, because there are certain races that you could be playing that would naturally actually be from one of those places.
Right.
If you're going to play a Kalashtar, or if you're going to play a Dragonborn even, there's a good chance you're from one of those other continents.
Right.
So let's talk about races. You have three new races, and then a bunch of other races that we got to figure out how do they fit into this world now. Our three new races are the Changeling, the Kalashtar, and the Warforged. Now, Warp...
New is kind of generous, really.
Well, all of these races existed in the previous edition.
Yeah, but I mean, the Changeling is basically the doppelganger from the Monster Manual, and Warforged were in the Monster Manual and then in Articles.
Yes.
Well, originally, the Changelings were different from the doppelgangers.
Yes, originally they were. It looks like the Changelings went through a bit of a change, so to speak.
Actually, it's more like they made the doppelgangers more like the Changelings than vice versa.
That's fair.
Because in the original version, Changelings were more like, they were kind of a half-breed race. They weren't actually half-breeds, but they were descended from people who, you know, got together with, who were half-breeds of doppelgangers and humans. So they're always going to be outcasts and such. The power setup that they have here is essentially the power setup that they had in 3rd edition with some minor variation, whereas in 3rd edition doppelgangers were actually reasonably powerful, and in 4th edition they brought them down to changeling level.
Yeah. But the changelings are, they're like, you know, as you would imply from a race descended from doppelgangers, they're able to change their appearance. They have an at-will minor power to disguise themselves. And so they're outcasts, but they try to fit into whatever society they happen to be around.
Yep.
What about the Kalashtar?
Kalashtar, kind of similar to what they had in 3rd edition. They are maybe cooler now. They are the result of what happens when the spirits from the realms of dreams running away from the Delcor fused with humans.
Right.
You end up with a actually somewhat limited number of these Kalashtar wandering around, running away from the Delcor, who have already begun to infest this world and protect the light. And they're very psychic and dream-oriented and all about the light.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because they're sort of a race without a class, because these are the people that are really meant to be psionic. And we don't have psionics for a while now. And then, of course, we have the Warforged, which were created during the war by House Caneth to be soldiers, living automatons, intelligent, sentient automatons. They're basically, I don't know, robots. That were intended to fight the war, and then the war ended, and they found themselves running around sentient creatures, intelligent creatures, and trying to figure out how to fit into the world.
And I believe they were basically essentially slaves during the war, and then there were a number of nations, I think, emancipated them as part of the final treaty. So I think it's a cool... I mean, I thought it was cool in 3rd edition. It's just as cool in 4th edition.
Yeah.
There's a reason why they released the playtest stuff on them really quick, because they're just interesting.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. And then they get into this whole section on, and this is how all the other races that you have from other books fit in. Again, right. Sort of bringing in this idea that everything's core.
Yeah.
But it does mean that you've got to make some tweaks to your setting to make it fit. You know,
Deva... Not a lot of tweaks here. The rarity of Devas means that, okay, they could have been wandering around.
And you just never ran into them before. Yeah. Dragonborn, we talked about it as being from Arganessen, which makes a lot of sense. Eladrin, they had to...
I think what they did with Eladrin was awesome.
They had to invent a story for Eladrin, but a lot of people who are Eberron fans, I've heard, are big fans of what they did with Eladrin.
Let me say, as the hardcore Eberron fan in our midst here, I really, really liked what they did with the Eladrin. I actually really liked the background on the Devas in Eberron better than the prime background for them. There is a slight difference, but that slight difference makes all the difference as far as I'm concerned.
Well, explain what's going on with those for us.
All right, so the Devas are not, you know, we're angels that fell to Earth or anything like that. In this particular case, they were just spirits of light that had been fighting with the alongside the Quaddles against the demon lords, the lords of dust, and helped them bind the lords of dust away into their prisons in Kyber, but now are stuck. They don't have anywhere to go.
That works. And what about Eladrin? What's the cool story that everybody loves about Eladrin?
I'll let somebody else take that one.
Well, I guess the Eladrin had seven mystical cities that I can't remember. What was the name of the plane that they were that they normally existed on?
It's their version of the Feywild, isn't it?
Yeah, so their version of the Feywild, right? And they would float back and forth, and you know they were kind of hidden from mortals, you know, kind of your classic Fey background, right? And then when the Mornland was created, one of these spire cities, one of these Fey world cities, was destroyed. It was caught in the Mornland, and that caused all the other Eladrin cities to appear with an Eberron and with all their cloaks down, basically, right? So now everybody can see these things, and they weren't necessarily in places where they fit in. I thought that was just very cool. I think it would be awesome to play an Eladrin character in Eberron. Like, it's almost like your alien fell to Earth kind of storyline. It's like, we don't want to be here. We want to leave. You know, it's a cool interaction.
Yeah, yeah.
I should also point out that a good portion of the really powerful and influential lords of dust are Rakshasas, and the Deva relation to Rakshasas
makes a lot of sense.
It is still in touch. So that also makes them much cooler here than perhaps maybe in a traditional D&D setting.
Sure. And then the other race that needed a little bit of working in was the Goliaths. Although it makes a little bit of sense that they would be from Zendrick, given that that was previously the realm of giants.
Right. And they actually get mentioned in 3rd edition because originally they were introduced in 3rd edition. They were, They actually briefly mentioned them in some of the supplements and explained that, yeah, these guys were found in Zendrick and some in Sarlona.
Yeah. And I always love the section of these books that talks about, you know, like in this one they call it the supporting cast, where it's just sort of the bullet list of, oh, yeah, and there's these races too, which you're not really supposed to be playing, but since we know you're going to want to anyway, we might as well tell you how to fit them in. You know, some of them are typically monsters like gnolls and goblins and kobolds and orcs and minotaurs, right? Usually not something that players are playing, but we know you're going to try to anyway, so here's how you make it work. And then the other one is the Genasi, which were introduced in Forgotten Realms, but since they know somebody's going to try to stick their Genasi into their Eberron, they give you at least a few paragraphs of saying, this is how you can make that make sense.
It really feels like the author doesn't want you to, though.
It does, doesn't it?
I think that there is something to be said for the fact that the write-ups that they give on some of these monster races that you could possibly play as a human are actually interesting. I mean, the kobolds in particular
are
like, I could see wanting to play a kobold. I mean, the fact that they become obsessed with one particular thing and follow it to its end result makes them sound really cool.
Well, and since Eberron is a world of gray and you do have kingdoms run by goblins and what have you, it does make some sense that these races would become player races.
Oh yeah, I think you could have a great character with like a hobgoblin who's questing for, you know, ruins of the ancient empire from a thousand years ago.
Yeah. All right.
One note on races. Shifters were introduced in the previous edition of Eberron.
Yes.
So they very much fit into this world more than you might expect.
Right. Okay, moving on to classes. We have one new class, the Artificer, which has been up on D&D Insider as sort of a playtest for a while. But this is your arcane leader. And it fits well into Eberron because the idea of the Artificer is that you're using your magic and infusing other people. You're using it to buff people and heal people and do those kinds of things, which makes sense in a world like Eberron where people are using magic in everyday life.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I found some of the the classes in 4E to be a little hit or miss. I wasn't a real big fan of like the cleric in the initial release, but Artificer was definitely one of those classes where I just read through and went, yeah, I really want to play this. Especially since they added in the ability to, my biggest concern with the Artificer in 4th edition was going to be that they weren't going to feel mechanical enough. Like they weren't going to be able to build magic items and do something with them. But in this build, you have powers that you can actually unleash, you know, little automatons that, you know, fight for you or help your assistants or whatever. Mm-hmm.
I will say that with the proper build, an Artificer becomes kind of sick by Paragon tier because they are using so many item daily powers that it gets kind of gross. I mean, really, a lot of them.
It could. They're full of awesome.
That and also, they can heal you without you spending a healing surge,
which is always nice.
Yeah.
Then you also have a whole list of Paragon paths that bring more flavor into the setting as well. Some built for the Artificer, but some also just built to give you some more of the story. You know, some that are made for the different races, some that are made for some of the different organizations and religions and that kind of stuff. But then you get into some more interesting things when you look at the Dragonmarked Paragon paths, which is going to sort of introduce us to the new mechanics for Dragonmarks.
Yeah.
Where there's feats that give you access to these dragon marks in a similar way to what they did in 3rd edition, but they work very differently because they tied it directly into, rather than you can do something once a day or whatever, they've now said the dragon marks work more like rituals.
Right.
But then you can sort of soup it up by taking a paragon path connected to your dragon mark. So rather than 3rd edition where it was, I take the least version of my dragon mark and then I can soup it up by taking another feat and then soup it up more by taking another feat and then crank it up again by taking another feat. This time you just take the one feat, but then you funnel yourself into a certain paragon path to focus on making that mark all that it can be.
Yeah.
And then they also have a new list of epic destinies. Anything exciting in the Epic Destinies?
I believe that the term is yawn.
I'm sorry, I skipped right over the Epic Destinies to go straight to the alchemical items. So,
I have yet to see many Epic Destinies that didn't make me want to yawn. So, in that case, they're consistent.
See, now I'm real hit and miss with Epic Destinies because I'm big into the story.
Right.
And Epic Destinies inform me how my character, how that story ends. Now, some of them are good at telling that story and some of them are not. And I've talked about that in many episodes at this point. There's nothing here that particularly stands out to me. I mean, your Epic Destiny can be that you become part of the Silver Flame or that you are a champion of the Draconic Prophecy and things like that, but there's only a handful of them and they just add some more flavor to Epic Destinies for Eberron.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then we get into our character option section. We got our feats, again, a mix of feats that give you lots of flavor for Eberron. And also your Dragonmarked feats. Do we like the new mechanics for Dragonmarks, since we're here?
Well, I can't say that they're bad. I mean, they weren't what I expected going into this. Honestly, I think I, like a lot of people, expected the spell plague sort of mechanic, the spell scar mechanics that they had in Forgotten Realms. I expected something like that, and they went a completely different direction, which is actually a little bit lower impact. You can get away with getting into Dragonmarks without really screwing over any other character part of your character concept because you had to spend a bunch of feats and a bunch of this and that to get into it.
Yeah, I think they maybe washed it out a little bit. Dragonmarks don't have the punch, or at least reading through them, they don't seem to have the punch in this edition that they had the potential to have in the previous incarnation. one of the things that always sort of attracted me to Eberron was the idea of dragon marks. In fourth edition, they just don't excite me.
I mean, they're not exciting per se, but for I spend 1 feat and I have an excuse to play in this whole intrigue side of things.
Yeah.
That's not bad. That's kind of like spending a feat to become a noble.
I suppose.
I can't compare it to the old rules, but they seem kind of weak to me, but I love the opening the possibility to get into the Dragonmark Paragon paths, because I think they're great.
Sure.
I mean, the Wind Riders are just amazing. So it seems like the feat is just, okay, you can dabble in it, but if you really want the punch, you got to go for the Paragon path.
Right.
I got to agree with Jeremiah. I think the real value of these ends up being the role-playing hooks. Even better than the background type things that you get when you're creating your character. I think this is the real meat of the setting. I mean, they could pack a little bit more of a punch, but I mean, for me as a character, I think the real value I would get from it is, oh, look what I can do through an organization.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You have an excuse to get into House Kenneth or something like that.
You also have a new mix of items and rituals introduced in this chapter. Lots of alchemical and magical items that fit in very well for Eberron.
Well, I'm glad to see him, honestly. I mean, that was another concern I had with 4E, was that there wasn't going to be enough of this kind of stuff. And they delivered. I mean, there's a couple pages worth of alchemical stuff. I'm still digging into it, but I was very pleased to see the amount of stuff we had.
Yeah, and they've actually, the alchemical side of things, they've done a lot more with when Adventurer's Vault came out, that was beyond what I expected from alchemical. And then they also introduced the idea of these dragon shards, which you can use to augment various items and what have you. Attach them to your other items, and it changes the way the item works. You've got Warforge components, so your Warforge can stick magic things onto their body.
I was disappointed with that, in only that they didn't have my favorite Warforge component from 3rd edition.
What's that?
It was a pair of wings.
Ah.
But one interesting change, they took all of the plating feats that you could have gotten in the previous edition, because you could take a feat to have adamantine in your structure or mithril in your structure, and it would make your character have a higher AC. They took all of those out and just made them Warforged components.
Yeah, which in some ways makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
that you could upgrade that way, and that you could work it like a component or an item. And then this last chapter is called The World of Eberron. It basically gives you some more information about the world and the different places in the world, sort of like you got in the first chapter, only this one's focused on, okay, you're from here, this is some stories that you can tell to be this kind of adventure, or these are some backgrounds that might make sense, sort of like how they did in the Forgotten Realms, that if you're from this place, this and that is your background, and here's how that affects your skills and what have you.
Right.
So they just give you some more ways to play a character, some ideas on how to play a character from the different parts of the world.
Yep.
And does that cover it?
I think that about covers it.
It better. We've been talking for an hour and 37 minutes, Skype tells me. Now, recording's a little shorter than that, but it's going to be a long episode.
You might break that into two.
I might, but I probably won't, so... Let's take one quick summary here. Did these books do what they're supposed to do? Have they met their purpose? Are they good? Who should buy them? Are they worth the cover price? Nick, go.
Well, they brought me from a complete ignorant person about Eberron to make me run a campaign and read the novel. So, yeah, they do their purpose. I'd recommend anyone pick up the player's guide and leaf through it. There's a lot of good ideas in there and some great paragon paths and new races. So even if you just want the crunch, there's some good stuff in there.
Yeah, I would say, and it was the same thing with the Forgotten Realms player's guide. There's enough there for any campaign. between the races and the classes and that kind of stuff. I would say in a lot of ways they learned the lessons of the Forgotten Realms books and did these books right.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think they did a great job. I mean, I do feel that as a GM, I wanted to have both books. I don't know that. I think as a player, you can get away with the player's guide just fine, but I think as a GM, you're going to want to have both.
I agree.
You know, just to know how the races and the classes come together, and you know, all of the Dragon Mark stuff. That kind of stuff is alluded to and talked about somewhat in the core, you know, campaign book. But I think to get into the nitty gritty, and even just to give out the treasure and stuff, you're going to need the player's book too.
Well, and I think the player's book is valuable to GMs and players of any setting.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Obviously, I'm kind of biased. I have some Warforged in my Forgotten Realms campaign, so
well,
there's and, stuff.
And I have every intention of sticking an Artificer in almost immediately when I get back to running that world.
Yeah, I think, you know, speaking as the guy who you know ran in third edition, the same campaign setting, they didn't make any changes that would change the tone of the game, change the tone of the setting, which pleased me a great deal. They did a few piddling things here and there that, you know, I was like, okay, well, they could have done that differently. But honestly, this is vastly, in my opinion, vastly better than what they did with the Forgotten Realms campaign guide, which left me just kind of frustrated.
Yes.
This was a very complete picture of the world without giving you all the details, that you can get into it.
And the Forgotten Realms guide, the big mistake they made is that they wanted to give you a detailed look at some of the world, but they didn't have enough space to do all of it. So they gave you a half look at some of the world. You know,
right.
and didn't do a thorough job and took up tons and tons of pages doing it. Whereas in this book, they give you a lot of other stuff and then give you just a brief overview of the world. The stuff that you need to know real quick as a player, done, and get it out of the way. And then they leave the details to the campaign guide. And I think they did this very well.
The previous edition, this setting was my favorite. Bar none of any third edition setting that was available, this was my favorite. And these new books coming out and filling out the details and keeping the tone the same, it's back to being my favorite setting.
I think that's actually a really important thing, because I think one of the criticisms of 4E, and I think based on what they did in Forgotten Realms, it's a valid one, was that, you know, you couldn't easily upgrade your campaign to 4E. And I think this is an example of a campaign setting that, you know, that did it and survived intact. You know, it might have been harder to do that with the Realms or Greyhawk or something like that, but at least with Eberron, and I could see the same thing happening with Dark Sun or, you know, Planescape, I think you can upgrade to 4E and not, you know, have it devastate your home world.
Absolutely. Nick, last thoughts?
Now that they've learned how to do campaign settings right in 4E, bring out Ravenloft.
I'd like him to redo the Forgotten Realms properly. But in any case, that's episode 113. I want to thank our guests for being on the episode. Ken, where can people find you?
You can find me at www.nuketown.com.
And Nick, where do people go to hear more from you?
I'm at dungeonmastering.com, and we just launched video.dungeonmastering.com, where I have a video blog actually reviewed the Eberron Player's Guide.
Sweet. And McCoy, what about you? Where should people go if they're interested in more of your rambling?
Well, I recently started a personal blog to make it easier to find all the stuff I do, so jeremiahmccoy.com.
And all of that will be linked in the show notes. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or swing by the Facebook group where we have a sort of backup forum going while we wait for the other one to get fixed. And I do send out occasional updates there. You can review the show on iTunes or tell people about it, like going to your next gaming event and letting a couple people know that you listen to the show. In fact, I'm going to make that your challenge of the episode. Go out and tell at least two people in person who are interested in gaming about the Tome Show. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed in the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. That, plus links to all the guests on the episode and more, will be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. Last stop. Everyone off the lightning rail. Into the line. You don't have to go home, but get off the train before I send my rabid shifter bodyguards after you. This has been episode 113, Eberron Campaign and Player's Guides of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.